welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, October 20, and I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. Of course, the front page story of the Gazette today, flurry in a hurry. Eastern Iowa gets an early taste of winter with unexpected snowfall. Winter is still 2 months away on the calendar, but its biggest calling card, snow, arrived Monday morning in Iowa in a hurry. Within just a few hours, the National Weather Service took reports of 9 inches in Polk City near Des Moines, 5 inches in northeast Cedar Rapids, among the highest snowfall amounts reported in the state. A little further south, the reported snowfall was less, about 2 inches in North Liberty. According to the Weather Service, the snowfall was most intense along the Highway 30 and Interstate 80 corridors in eastern Iowa. How long will the white cover stick around? Probably not very. The forecast calls for chances of rain and increasingly warmer temperatures through Thursday, where the forecast predicts a short-lived high in the 70s. Winter does not arrive, at least on the calendar, until December 21. On another front page story, the Cedar Rapids staff outlines police review board. This story is by Marissa Payne. The city staff is recommending a narrower scope of powers for a citizens' law enforcement review board than what racial justice advocates have called for, limiting the board's authority to investigate allegations of police misconduct and issue reprimands. The Cedar Rapids City Council is scheduled to hear a community development staff presentation at its 4 p.m. meeting today, further detailing the recommendations for how a potential board could be structured. According to the city staff's proposal for key elements of Citizens Review Board, the panel would review results of professional standards investigations via a police chief's report. An investigation would be completed within 60 days of a citizen's complaint, and the chief would provide a report on the findings at the next scheduled board meeting. If the panel, whose members would have access to body camera footage and audio, has questions about the outcome of the investigation, it could have a closed session discussion with the chief and return the matter to the chief for more consideration. The board could issue recommendations on departmental policy and could seek a full independent investigation from a state ombudsman. Personnel information shared with the panel would be discussed only in closed session and made confidential. The Advocates for Social Justice, the local Black Lives Matter group that prompted the 9-member council to commit to 7 demands for police reform after George Floyd's killing May 25 by Minneapolis police, called for broader investigative powers in recommendations it unveiled in July. While a CRB can offer residents confidence that their complaints of misconduct or harassment will be taken seriously and investigated, to rely solely on complaints as the basis for what the CRB may consider would be to put the burden of correcting systemic disparities on individual residents, the group's research memo states. City staff's recommendations grant the board some involvement in hiring a police chief by designating the panel's chair or a designee to serve on a police chief candidate selection committee. The staff also suggests that issues of the chief's conduct be remanded to the state ombudsman. The advocates, however, recommended the citizens' board have full authority to fire the police chief. The city staff recommendations are in line with the advocates' request that the board receive and review quarterly reports from the police chief, including data such as police stops and arrests, with breakdowns of racial and ethnic demographic information. The panel would review police data to identify areas of improvement and establish a baseline to track progress and issue recommendations to the city on police policies and practices. There would be quarterly public forums to discuss policies, procedures, and data to promote public engagement, awareness, and relationship building, city staff recommend. Finally, the staff proposes 9 residents serve on the panel with a gender balance and with at least 50% of members being people of color. The advocates had asked for strong representation of people of color as members of marginalized communities are disproportionately surveilled, arrested, and incarcerated, according to their memo. Those chosen to sit on the panel would serve staggered three-year terms, and their service would be capped at two terms. Initial members would serve at least 2 years. Recommendations for the board's membership largely aligned with the advocates' recommendations, although the advocates asked that most subsequent members be chosen by current members and allowed for the mayor to choose two members, all subject to council approval. Under the staff proposal, there would be training for panel members and resources necessary to perform duties and functions assigned, as well as staffing to be determined later. The staff recommendations were drafted based on survey responses from more than 2,200 Cedar Rapids residents and focus group meetings, where a majority of residents reported that they backed the city's formation of a board. The council members will not take a final vote today on the panel structure. They may consider advancing a resolution that would allow the city manager to draft an ordinance, so the council may later consider it after a public hearing and the full ordinance passing process. In another front page story, today, the UI spends $230,000 on lodgings for COVID-19 athletes. Other UI students who test positive are put in residence halls. This story is by Aaron Jordan. The University of Iowa Athletics Department has spent more than $230,000 since June putting about 180 COVID-19 positive student athletes up in hotel rooms and paying for their food. The total includes $192,713 on 1,665 nights in an undisclosed Iowa City area hotel between June 1 and September 30, according to data the athletics department provided after request from the Gazette. On six occasions, or 48 nights days, student athletes shared rooms. Deducting that from the total number of night stays amounts to 1,617, which divided by the total cost comes to about $120 per room per night. The UI paid another $40,983 of per diem payments for student athlete food while they were in hotel isolation. UI Housing and Dining has made 250 to 300 residence hall rooms across campus available for students to use for quarantine and isolation. But Andy Peterson, a UI pediatrician and head team physician, said the athletics department decided to have most student athletes stay in a hotel because they live off campus with other student athletes. While not all student athletes are directed to a hotel, in many cases, this has been determined as the ideal location for isolation and reducing additional contact with a roommate or teammate, he said in an email. COVID-19 has pummeled college sports programs across the country. The UI Athletics Department in September projected a $75 million deficit for this year, primarily due to lost TV revenue from football. Athletics Director Gary Barta cut four sports, men's tennis, men's and women's swimming and diving, and men's gymnastics, August 21st. Supporters of these sports say they have raised about $3 million to save the sports, but so far haven't gotten traction with UI administrators. Not only is there lost revenue, but programs must spend more on testing and protective equipment to try and keep student athletes safe. UI student athletes with positive tests stayed from one night to 15 nights in the hotel, records show. The median stay was 10 nights. This is consistent with the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention's recommendation that someone who tested positive for the disease may stop isolating 10 days after symptoms first appeared, after at least 24 hours with no fever, and most other symptoms are improving. We are following the guidance of our medical professionals that have required a 10-day isolation for those individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19 and a 14-day quarantine for those individuals who have been identified as having close contact with a known positive, said Barbara Burke, Deputy Athletics Director. The UI can't release the names of student athletes who have tested positive for COVID-19 because of student and medical privacy laws,
but some players have shared the information. Men's basketball player Jordan Bohannon said he and six other teammates tested positive for the disease in early August. The Des Moines Register reported, Bohannon, a senior, said he had fever, chills, and vomiting. I couldn't even lay my head on a pillow without wanting to start crying, he told Chris Leistikow in a September interview. UI Athletics announced August 31st all sports practices would be shut down through September 7 because of 93 positive tests August 24th through the 30th. That surge of cases is mirrored in the hotel isolation numbers, which show 19 student athletes isolating in June, 22 in July, 105 in August, and 39 in September. Players who test positive can't return to their sport for 21 days, according to Big Ten protocol. While in isolation, student athletes have to undergo cardiac testing and be cleared by a cardiologist before they can return to play, said James Torner, a UI professor of epidemiology, surgery, and neurosurgery, who is the athletic department's chief infection officer, a new position required by the Big Ten. Torner told the Presidential Committee on Athletics on October 1, student athletes in hotel isolation take a survey each morning about their health status, including mental health. If it reaches a trigger level, sports psychology gets in touch with the athletes, Torner said. Megan Conroy, a junior field hockey player and officer with the Iowa Student Athlete Advisory Committee, told the committee she recently had completed a second quarantine after being around someone who tested positive. If you've encountered someone positive in the past 72 hours, you have to go into quarantine, she said. If you're not in your apartment, you're wearing your mask around everyone. Most Big Ten fall sports, including field hockey, cross country, volleyball, and soccer, have been postponed with the possibility they can resume in the spring. But the conference decided September 15 to allow a late start football season. Iowa will play its first game of the season Saturday at Purdue. Moving to the Iowa Today page, St. Luke's Heart Center completes a $5 million renovation. This story is by Michaela Ram. Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids has completed a $5 million renovation of its Heart Center. The months-long project at the NASIF Heart Center in Cedar Rapids, the hub of St. Luke's Hospital's cardiac care, finished this week, officials said Monday. The 44,000-square-foot, two-floor space first opened in 2000. The project included $3 million in medical equipment upgrades, including a new imaging system and new ancillary equipment, according to the news release. As medical technology has improved over the past 20 years, health system officials said enhancements to the center's services were needed. The renovation began with a need to update our imaging technology in the catheterization labs, Casey Green, Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, said in a news release. As the area's heart hospital, we are proud to invest in upgrading our patient and team member areas. The new cardiovascular imaging technology in the Heart Center meets requirements for peripheral, vascular, and coronary procedures, according to Mark Bucci, St. Luke's Heart Center manager. He also said in a news release that the system delivers optimal image quality at the lowest radiation level, making it safer for patients. The project included work updating patient rooms. In addition, the project added a lobby, a new consultation area, nurses' station, and other staff areas. In 2019, St. Luke's performed nearly 1,700 diagnostic cardiac catheterizations and 27,000 diagnostic cardiology exams. Cardiac providers also performed 260 open-heart surgeries, 700 electrophysiology procedures, and 6,100 outpatient cardiac rehab sessions, according to hospital officials. Also on the Iowa Today page, GuideLink Center to open early 2021. This story by Lee Hermiston. Iowa City's new behavioral access center, called the GuideLink Center, is scheduled to open early next year. Construction is currently about 80% complete, said Matthew Miller, project manager. During a meeting Monday of local officials, including from Iowa City, Coralville, North Liberty, University Heights, Johnson County, and the Iowa City Community School District, Miller said construction is anticipated to be complete January 2nd on the facility at 270 Southgate Avenue in South Iowa City. It is expected to open to the public February 8th. Once completed, the project will house sobering and crisis stabilization units and a low-barrier homeless shelter. The shelter would not require people to be sober in order to be admitted. The center is part of a years-long reimagining of Johnson County's response to those dealing with mental health and substance abuse crises. Starting in May 2015, local law enforcement agencies sent officers and deputies to San Antonio, Texas, to be trained in crisis intervention, an approach that teaches participants how to recognize when someone is having a mental health issue or other crisis and how to de-escalate the situation. Even with the training, officials said police were limited in their options on where to take someone experiencing a crisis, either to jail or a hospital. That's where the new GuideLink Center comes in. Miller told the Gazette that residents will be able to access the center in a variety of ways. Family members or friends can take someone there. Law enforcement also can take an individual there in need of services. Once someone arrives, they will go through our initial evaluation and intake process, then be admitted and start whatever treatment is immediately needed, Miller said. People are allowed to simply show up and walk in or call ahead to give staff a heads up. Agencies outside of law enforcement are also encouraged to refer patients to the center, Miller said. Entities outside Johnson County are encouraged to use the GuideLink Center as well. Outside entities are supportive of the project, Miller said. For instance, Iowa County has donated $100,000 to building expenses. Linn County is opening its own access center. Miller told the local officials that Linn County intends to open its facility by mid-November. In another Iowa Today story, the ISU and UI tally some losses in the U.S. News Global Rankings. This story is by Vanessa Miller. The Gazette has printed or has information from the new U.S. News and World Report rankings for colleges and universities globally that show Iowa State University and University of Iowa slipped in some of their best-ranked subjects, including engineering and plant and animal sciences at ISU and psychology, neuroscience, arts, and humanities at the UI. Overall, Iowa State continued its slide in the international rankings from number 204 3 years ago to number 212 2 years ago to number 220 last year, now number 231. UI held mostly steady this year at number 160 compared to last year's number 161. The UI had been losing ground, slipping from number 153 3 years ago to number 159 2 years ago. U.S. News and World Report, esteemed globally as a guide to higher education and often cited locally among universities aiming to recruit students and faculty, released national rankings in September, showing UI likewise maintained its number 34 spot among public schools. The Hawkeyes slipped, though, from number 84 to number 88 among all national universities. Meanwhile, Iowa State improved its standing among all national institutions, jumping from number 121 to number 118. It also stepped up one from number 55 to 54 among public schools. UI President Bruce Harreld over the years has stressed the importance of the U.S. news metric as a reflection of a variety of key indicators of the quality of a university education, mentioning it recently in his retirement announcement. Throughout his time at the UI, Harreld urged the university to aspire to higher national rankings and to focus and invest in its strengths, such as its creative writing program, according to the UI Office of Strategic Communications summary of Harreld's tenure. U.S. News and World Report this fall named UI the top-ranked public institution and 13th overall in a new ranking that recognizes the importance of teaching, writing, and communications in all disciplines. Looking at specific disciplines internationally, though, UI in the new rankings lost ground in some of its high-strength subjects. In psychiatry, UI slipped from number 81 to number 92. In neuroscience and behavior, UI dipped from 93 to 97. In surgery, it dropped from number 102 to number 118. In immunology, UI fell from number 116 to 138. In arts and humanities, it went from 119 to 131. And in economics and business, it tumbled from 157 to 173. Iowa State similarly lost ground in some of its best-ranked subjects. In plant and animal science, ISU dropped from 23 to 29. In agricultural science, it ticked down from number 36 to 37. In environment and ecology, it slipped from 145 to 155. In economics and business, ISU dipped from 173 to 177. And in engineering, it fell from 191 to 208. This year's U.S. News Global Rankings include schools from 86 countries, with the U.S. tallying the most at 255. China has the second most at 176, followed by the United Kingdom with 87, France with 70, and Germany with 68. Just two countries are represented in the overall top 10, the U.S. and the U.K. Now moving to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from the Washington Post titled A Ray of Hope. Since the mid-1980s, about half the states have changed their laws to expand voting rights for felons, generally those who already have served their sentences. Yet, until recently, the number of convicts shut out of the polls soared anyway, a product largely of the nation's enthusiasm for locking up even nonviolent criminals. Virtually no Western democracy disenfranchises so many of its citizens as the United States, and a hugely disproportionate number of those barred from voting are black. Against that dispiriting backdrop, there is finally a ray of good news. In this presidential election year, for the first time in decades, the number of Americans disenfranchised owing to a federal conviction has fallen from about 5.2 million, nearly a million fewer than 2016. About a quarter of them remain behind bars. The rest are ex-convicts who remain deprived of their full rights even though they are no longer incarcerated. These figures, contained in a new study by the Nonpartisan Sentencing Project, reflect an encouraging recent trend. They also suggest how deep a hole remains for many ensnared in the criminal justice system. In parts of the Deep South and a few other states, more than one in seven African Americans cannot vote because of felony conviction. In Tennessee, Mississippi, and Alabama, more than 8% of all adults are shut out from the polls because of felony conviction. Then there's Florida, where a Republican crusade to deprive citizens of the vote is its own special disgrace. In the Sunshine State alone, some 1.1 million felons are barred from the polls, including 900,000 who are no longer behind bars. For that, blame the efforts of GOP state lawmakers for successfully reversing the intent of nearly two-thirds of Floridians who voted in a referendum to restore former felons' voting rights in 2018. Nationwide, roughly 6.2% of black adults have been disenfranchised, nearly four times the share of other Americans similarly barred from the polls. Still, there is reason for optimism. Throughout the Northeast and most of the Midwest, those who have lost the vote are limited mainly to current inmates. In the past few years, a Republican governor in Iowa and Democratic governors in Kentucky and Virginia have issued executive orders restoring the vote to most ex-convicts who have completed their sentences. The trajectory is encouraging even among blacks, the disenfranchised share of whom has fallen by about a quarter since 2004. In the march toward a more perfect union, one in which those who have paid their debt to society are made whole, progress remains halting, but at least there is progress. Nationwide, roughly 6.2% of black adults have been disenfranchised, nearly four times the share of other Americans similarly barred from the polls. And again, that was a reprint from the Washington Post's Sunday edition, A Ray of Hope. One community letter today, vote for Lonnie Polbrebeck for Iowa House District 73. 10 years ago, it was odd that Iowa District 73 was drawn with straight edges and an attractive wandering line along the Iowa River. Perhaps the artist's hand shook a bit as he drew the southern border. It was suddenly interrupted, adding a tiny, jagged appendage that just included Wilton. Just 2 years later, Bobby Kaufman from Wilton, whose dad is chairman of the House Republican Party, ran for State House District 73. Bobby has used his four terms fighting with the elected representatives of Johnson County. He doesn't seem to like us very much. He brags about voting for $756 million for public schools, a goodly sum, but not quite up to inflation and less than half of what's needed. Let's look with hope to the future. Sheriff Lonnie Polbrebeck has served Iowa for 35 years. He is a strong advocate for public education and has earned the endorsement of the Iowa State Education Association. He spearheaded the effort to create a jail diversion program for people suffering from mental health problems, to train law enforcement officers to recognize citizens in crisis, and to de-escalate situations. He's experienced, moral, kind, and looks for ways to help us. Please vote for Lonnie. We need him in these unsettled times. And that letter to the editor is signed by James Folk, MD, from Iowa City. And in another Iowa Today story, hospitalizations continue to increase in Iowa as COVID-19 cases near 108,000. This story is by Kat Russell for the Gazette. Iowa reported its second highest number of hospitalizations in a 24-hour period Monday, as the total number of positive COVID-19 cases nears 108,000. According to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health, 480 COVID-19 patients were hospitalized as of 11 a.m. Monday, marking the second highest number of hospitalizations seen in a 24-hour period in the state since the beginning of the pandemic. The highest number of hospitalizations in a 24-hour period was 482, recorded just 5 days earlier, October 14th. Out of the 2,898 test results that were reported in the past 24 hours, Iowa added 523 new cases, bringing the state's total to 107,580. The remaining 2,375 tests came back negative or inconclusive, making the 24-hour positivity rate 18.05%. Iowa also reported 8 new deaths in 5 counties, bringing the total number of Iowans that have succumbed to the virus to 1,536. Lynn, Iowa, and Woodbury counties reported 2 deaths each, according to the data, while O'Brien and Plymouth counties each reported 1. Lynn County added 31 cases as of 11 a.m. Monday, bringing its total to 3,024 and its 7-day average to 49. A peak 7-day average that has only been seen twice before, on October 2 and 3. The county's 24-hour positivity rate is 11.07%. Johnson County added 9 cases in the past 24 hours, bringing its total to 5,624. The county's 7-day average is 22, and its 24-hour positivity rate is 5.7%. The top 10 counties in total cases are: number 1, Polk County; 2, Woodbury County; number 3, Johnson County; number 4, Black Hawk County; number 5, Lynn County; number 6, Dubuque County; number 7, Scott County; number 8, Story County; number 9, Dallas County; and number 10, Pottawatomie County. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, October 20th. On the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to the obituaries in today's paper. In the short notices, from Edgewood, Ray J. Ward, age 103, died Monday, October 19th, the Leonard Muller Funeral Home and Crematory in Edgewood is assisting. In Hopkinton, Joanne Dingbaum, aged 83, died Sunday, October 18th. The Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello is assisting. From Independence, Mary Ann Althaus, age 82, died Thursday, October 15th. The Reef Family Center and Funeral Home in Independence is assisting. And from Tama, Emerson Brown Tenorio, age 30, died Saturday, October 17th. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo is assisting. In West Union, Ruth Ann Irby, age 87, died Monday, October 19th. The Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Postville is assisting. And also in West Union, Doris Sabo, age 92, died Sunday, October 18th. The Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in West Union is assisting. In Winthrop, Edward, known as Ed Auer, Sr., age 92, died Sunday, October 18th. The Fawcett Schmitz Funeral Home in Winthrop is assisting. And in another announcement, Stephen J. Frimmo, age 67, of Nampa, Idaho, died Thursday, October 8th. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting that family. And on to the longer notices. From Amana, Scott, known as Scotty A. Owl, age 63, of Abana, passed away Sunday, October 18th at the Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Graveside services at 11 a.m. Wednesday, October 21st at St. John's Cemetery in Homestead. The Hrabic Newhouse Funeral Service of Belle Plaine is assisting Scott's family in their time of need. And from Hopkinton, Bill William Boyles, age 86, passed away Thursday, October 15th at Pinnacon Place in Anamosa. Services will be held at a later date. The Getch Funeral Home Monticello has taken Bill and his family into their care. From Cedar Rapids, longtime resident Robert Boyd Harris passed away October 7 at his home in Rio Verde, Arizona. He was 89 years old. A service for Boyd Harris will be held this coming spring in Des Moines, Iowa. From Coggin, Alo M. Poppy Bell, age 100, of Marion, formerly of Coggin, died Friday, October 16th, at the Lynn Manor Care Center. Services are at 11 a.m. Friday at First Assembly of God in Cedar Rapids. Dr. Brian Pingle will officiate. Burial will be at the Coggin Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 Friday at the church. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced and the use of face masks or shields is required. From Cedar Rapids, Neva Green, age 83, died Saturday, October 17th at the Hiawatha Care Center. Because of COVID-19, there will be no visitation and services are private. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Neva Green. From Cedar Rapids, Justin Curtis Ilg, age 32, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Friday, October 16th at St. Luke's Hospital after a 2.5-year courageous battle with lung cancer. A visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private family service will be held Friday, October 23rd at St. Paul's United Methodist Church. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements for Justin Curtis Ilg. Also from Cedar Rapids, Greg Jones, age 71, died Sunday, October 18th at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospice, Cedar Rapids. Private family services will be held at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church and burial will be at Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in charge of arrangements for Greg Jones. Also in Cedar Rapids, Leah May Lander. Entombment is at Cedar Memorial Park and there will be no visitation. Again, that's for Leah May Lander. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements. She died at her residence October 16th at Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Trina Jo Merstick Siebert, age 60, of Alvin, Texas, passed away on October 13th. No other information is provided for Trina Jo Siebert. In Van Horn, Lorraine R. Kelly, age 94, passed away Sunday, October 18th, at Hospice of Mercy in Hiawatha. Private family mass of Christian burial will be held at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Van Horn, with the Reverend Craig Stemmel as celebrant. Interment will be held at Calvary Cemetery, rural Van Horn. Again, that's for Lorraine Kelly, and the Phillips Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Central City, Lois Eileen Lawrence, age 88, passed away Sunday, October 18th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha following a long illness. Because of the ongoing pandemic, a private family funeral mass will be held Thursday, October 22nd at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Central City, with the Reverend Nick March officiating. Burial will follow at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Prairieburg, Iowa. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City is assisting the family of Lois Lawrence. From Iowa City, Howard Marvin Scriver, age 89, passed away Sunday, October 18th at Iowa City Rehab. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, October 22nd at the West Branch Cemetery. Military honors will be performed by the American Legion. The Lansing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Howard Scriver. And from Manchester, Mary T. Morris, age 85, of Manchester, passed away Monday, October 19th at the Good Neighbor Home. She was born in 1935 in Hopkinton. Online condolences may be left at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home website. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, October 22nd, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Masonville, the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 21st, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may call between 8:30 and 9:45 a.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Interment will be at the Oakland Cemetery in Manchester. Moving to high school sports, high school volleyball. Classic rivals open the postseason tonight. This story is by Jeff Linder. The list of area matches is few, actually two, as the Class 5A volleyball postseason begins, and none of the four teams participating have winning records. But here's all that needs to be said. Jeff Wash, City West, and that's worth as much as gaudy records and high rankings. Our record doesn't show how the growth we've made this season, Cedar Rapids Jefferson coach Amy Norton said, and the same could be said for tonight's other combatants. Jayhawks, 8-17, host Cedar Rapids Washington, 2-29, and Iowa City West, 12-14, is at Iowa City High, 7-10. Both 5A regional quarterfinals start at 7 p.m. We've made good progress, Norton said. We've kept challenging these girls, and I've never had a team that has improved as much throughout the season as this one. It's not the most athletic team we've had, and we're not super dynamic. We live and die with each serve reception. If we can serve receive, things go a lot better for us. And despite the record, the Jayhawks have had some good moments, taking at least one set from 6 of 7 opponents in MVC Valley Division matches. We've taken steps forward in all areas, Norton said. As for Washington, all we have to do is remind the girls that they beat Cedar Rapids Kennedy on October 13th, Norton said. City and West met once in the regular season. The Little Hawks earned a sweep October 1, but the Trojans enter tonight with a 3-match winning streak, including an upset victory over Dubuque Hempstead. Class 4A regionals also open tonight, and the top area team in action is Decorah, with a record of 18-11. The Northeast Iowa Conference runner-up. The Vikings host Mason City with a record of 4-20. Tonight's winners advance to the regional semifinals on Thursday. And in another high school sports story, Schrock Mount Vernon enjoyed defeating Solon. Yeah, Lauren Schrock heard it. I think they were booing me during pregame instructions and introductions, Schrock said of her former classmates at Solon High School. Her response was both tactful and memorable. Schrock tallied 18 kills, including 5 during a defining stretch at the end of the second set, and Class 3A third-ranked Mount Vernon silenced Solon 25-10, 25-23, 25-15 in a Class 3A volleyball regional quarterfinal last night at Mount Vernon High. A senior who transferred from Solon to Mount Vernon following her sophomore year, Schrock heard the negative reception, but she wasn't rattled. "It's still kind of different," she said. "I used to be on the other side of the net. I just try to block it all out." Lauren can be an emotional person, and she has made tremendous growth, Mustangs coach Maggie Willems said. Instead of getting emotional, at least outwardly, Schrock exhibited an angry swing. The Mustangs, with a record of 28-6, trailed the second set 23-18 before their final surge. Cameron Ellison started it with a kill, then it was Schrock, then Sarah Romberg. Then Schrock rattled off 4 in a row, and in the blink of an eye, Mount Vernon held a 2-set lead. "When she came in at 22-18, I still thought we had a chance to win the set," Willems said. "We had been spreading our errors around. I thought if we could settle in and get big swings, done. I kept hitting inside balls and it wasn't working," Schrock said. "I had to get out to the pin, and Sydney got me the ball perfectly." Up next, Williamsburg, 19-15, in a regional semifinal at 7 p.m. here Wednesday. On the way to the 3A state championship last year, the Mustangs won 4 consecutive 5-set matches. They'd like to avoid that kind of drama this time around. "I can't do another postseason like that," Willems said. Ellison added 11 kills, Maddie Cranston and Natalie Welch 7 apiece, and the Mustangs enjoyed a 50-23 advantage in kills. Dennis collected 42 assists. Caitlin Jetter led Solon, with a record of 17-19, with 10 kills. Moving to the Business 380 page, 5 corridor businesses get thousands in state CARES apprenticeship grants. This story's by John Steppy. 4 Cedar Rapids companies and 1 Iowa City company received apprenticeship grants through the Coronavirus Relief Fund Registered Apprenticeship Expansion on Monday. The new Bohemian Innovative Collaboration in Cedar Rapids received $49,950, the largest grant among corridor companies. It will expand an existing apprenticeship program by hiring application and digital marketing developers. Metro Pavers in Iowa City had the second highest grant in the corridor, with $49,517 for 2 apprenticeships, 1 existing apprenticeship and a new one for a concrete mason. Cedar Rapids Tank Wash received $47,431 for virtual training systems as part of its welding program. Iron Workers Local Union No. 89 received $44,326 to buy equipment for forklift and aerial lift training. The Area Substance Abuse Council in Cedar Rapids received $29,531 for a new program that will engage 40 Iowans annually to advance their skills and education in the behavioral health field. Other Eastern Iowa grant recipients included West Delaware Community School District in Manchester, Bovard Studio in Fairfield, and Bogue Mechanical Systems and BAC Certified Public Accountants in Dyersville. The state also released application information for the Coronavirus Relief Earn and Learn Grant, which is available for not-for-profits, unions, businesses with fewer than 50 employees, post-secondary educational institutions, and other adult training providers. Applications are due October 26th and should be submitted through iowagrants.gov. Recipients will then have to spend the money by the end of 2020. Earn and Learn grants can go up to $250,000, with no more than 10% going to administrative costs. Recipients of the Coronavirus Relief Fund Registered Apprenticeship Expansion grants are not eligible. We hope The grants will create projects to address the workforce barriers Iowa faces in recovering from the pandemic and provide critical workforce support, Reynolds said in a news release. The projects will target Iowans whose jobs have been affected by the pandemic and get them back to work in exciting new careers. A story on the community page is called Creating Keepsakes. Coasters made from fallen trees will benefit area nonprofits. Nuboco, Indian Creek Nature Center, Bruce Moore, and Iowa Big students are carving a piece of history out of the derecho for good. Pieces from the fallen trees at the Nature Center and Bruce Moore's historic estate are being turned into coasters in time for holiday giving and for giving a helping hand to area arts and cultural nonprofits. Orders must be placed by October 30th so the coasters can be ready for pickup or delivery by the target date of December 6th. That gives the staff and volunteer elves at Nuboco and Iowa Big, as well as the supplying chainsaw gang, the month of November to cut, sand, dry, laser etch the logos, seal the surfaces, and add protective cork to the underside of each piece. Late last week, orders already had stacked up for 2,400 coasters. Cost is $20 for a set of four, and buyers can choose logos from 21 nonprofits, including museums, performing arts groups, and presenters. Seven more whimsical designs range from Cedarecho and Dumpster Fire 2020 to Iowa Chainsaw Massacre and an uplifting Iowa Strong. Even a blank set is in the mix. Proceeds will be split among the nonprofits, with one-third going to the organization whose logo is purchased. The fundraiser was kind of a lark, and it seems to have caught some wind here, said Eric Engelman, Nuboco's executive director. Short for New Bohemian Innovative Collaborative, the nonprofit organization supports entrepreneurship, innovation, and tech education, and operates out of the Geometric Building in Cedar Rapids' Nubo District. We were just talking about ways we could help the nonprofits in the area, and in particular the arts and culture ones, he said. It seems like a lot of the ones that are more health and human service focused have found ways to raise money in the aftermath of COVID and derecho. I'm also an owner in a wedding venue, an event center, and friends with a bunch of other nonprofits around here. We were talking about how much pain a lot of these organizations are in. We thought Nuboco could help raise money in some creative way, so we thought, what do we have a lot of for cheap raw materials? We have a lot of wood around here. And Indian Creek Nature Center and Bruce Moore have a lot of wood to part with, Engelman said. Those groups are supplying and cutting wood since they have the expertise and equipment. The Nature Center lost over half of its tree canopy, said Executive Director John Myers, and sustained damage to its forest, trails, outbuildings, and barns at the farm the organization owns north of Marion. The main buildings, the amazing space, and the original barn center nearby are fine, Myers said, adding that volunteers have worked more than 1,000 hours since the August 10 storm. Bruce Moore lost 70% of its tree canopy and sustained $2.5 million in damages to buildings and grounds. Coasters with the Bruce Moore logo will be made from its fallen trees. We have the opportunity to take not only the pandemic but the storm and make lemonade out of lemons, Myers said. We have all this wood, and this, of course, will not get rid of even a fraction of it, and that's not the goal. The goal is to celebrate the fact that we can come back and can be resilient, as this community has been since the 2008 flood. It's not just about the Nature Center or Bruce Moore, he said. It's really about the entire cultural and arts nonprofit community. This is one of the things that makes this community great. This is probably just a small piece of it, but we want Theater Cedar Rapids to be healthy. We want Nubo City Market to be healthy. We want the Museum of Art to be healthy. If they are healthy, then the Nature Center and Bruce Moore will be well. The more we can help each other out, the better off we'll be. The wood grain in the coasters is a thing of beauty springing from the sorrow of a storm's destruction, Myers pointed out. A lot of people have been chainsawing and clearing over the past 2 months, and wood may not have the positive vibe for some of us right now, so to be able to take this and turn it into a beautiful piece, one is one of our goals. Coaster production has barely begun, Engelman noted, but so far a couple of students from Iowa Big, an initiative-based high school enrichment program, are participating and learning about laser etching technology and e-commerce alongside NuboCo staff and interns. NuboCo will call upon its volunteer network for packaging and distribution. We've sold more than we expected, Engelman said. He was hoping to sell $10,000 worth of coasters over the three-week period, but sales have exceeded that, and he's worried they may have to end sales early so they can fill the orders already placed. Originally, the goal was to do something fun for a few people, Engelman said. Now it's really about helping all the nonprofits that are hurting because of COVID and derecho, that can't do the events, that can't do the programs where normally they make money, to help them grow and thrive. And maybe this is an easy thing that we can do that's kind of fun and unique. Something that may be a keepsake that people can have for a long time to remember 2020 by, for good or bad. Trees are such a benefit to the environment, Meyer said. We lost a lot of trees, and we have a lot of work to do in front of us, but this way is one way we are able to celebrate the great trees that we did have. And at a glance, this is the Derecho Drink Coasters fundraiser project. Orders are accepted through October 30th at derecho2020.myshopify.com. The cost, again, is $20 per set of four, and you can view them online. Proceeds will be divided among the designated Iowa Arts Councils and nonprofits. Organizers are the NuboCo, Iowa Big, Indian Creek Nature Center, and Bruce Moore. That does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, October 20. I've been your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced two drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early-stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive, compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthily, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The author suggests that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.